And it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use, brought to you right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM. Let's start off with announcements, but before we do, I want to remind you to have a pencil and paper handy, because maybe one of these announcements could be important to you, and you wouldn't want to forget it. So, take some notes. Open your journal. Figure out what you're going to do for the next few days or weeks. Let's start off with Alameda Creek cleanup. That's going to happen on April 19th. These really great folks over in the East Bay, they've got themselves a steelhead and trout stream that they're trying to restore. So please help the Alameda Creek Alliance clean or adopt a spot at the bottom of the Niles Canyon on Saturday, April 19th. We will also be pulling invasive ivy off of trees in the riparian corridor. To help, contact Ralph at alamedacreek.org. That's his email address, ralph@alamedacreek.org. For more info, some really great folks over there at the Alameda Creek Alliance. So go help them out April 19th. Contact Ralph at alamedacreek.org. And here's some really big news. We thought we had big news last week when the International Court ruled that Japan's whaling was not legal. But here we have something almost as big. Rio Tinto has pulled out of the Pebble Mine up in Alaska, citing widespread opposition in this story by Bonnie Gestring of Earthworks, as featured on the Earth First Newswire. Earthworks applauds Rio Tinto's decision to withdraw from the Pebble Mine proposal that threatens Alaska's Bristol Bay watershed, home to the world's largest wild sockeye salmon fishery. We also applaud their recognition that Alaskans should have a say in Pebble's future development, and Alaskans have had their say. They overwhelmingly oppose the mine. 98% of comments from Bristol Bay residents oppose the Pebble Mine proposal. That's largely because, as the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's peer-reviewed scientific assessment of large-scale mining impact in the watershed showed, the Pebble Mine would destroy 94 miles of salmon streams and threaten a $480 million per year salmon fishery and the 14,000 or more jobs that depend on it. With Rio Tinto's departure following close upon Anglo American's withdrawal last year, there is currently no major funder backing the Pebble Mine proposal. Perhaps more importantly, there is now no mining company that is in Pebble Mine that has actually done mining of anything. Rio Tinto's divestment from Pebble may not be the final nail in the coffin, but it's surely one of the last. And hopefully we'll think of the Pebble Mine as the mine that never was. That'd be a great way to think of it. News from Italy. The Animal Liberation Front has destroyed all the cages at a new mink farm. In this story from Bite Back, as found on the Earth First Newswire, deconstruction of an anthropocentric practice, or the meticulous task of dismantling a mink farm under construction, was performed in the night between March 25th and 26th in Capernaccia in the province of Cremona, Italy, at the property owned by a master farmer. The farm's status before the operation, 8 concrete slabs, 4 sheds, of which 2 were already set up with cages, and a concrete structure with only the walls completed. Actions. 3 convenient holes were opened in the perimeter fence. Steel gate locks were glued with liquid nail solution. The cages, called nests, were crushed one by one. The opening mechanisms of all the cages were cut and the doors damaged, and holes were created in the back of the cages. And important metal parts of the cages were removed and stolen. 3 water pumps were also made to disappear. The electrical system was removed. The meter in a small office on site was damaged, then locked, and then, unfortunately, the keys were lost. The cable on the electric concrete mixer was cut, and left behind was a message, "Change your mind," painted everywhere. Conclusion? This sabotage action hit the farm before the start of production, or destruction, as you might say, and its first revenue resulting from the sale of skins next winter. if the owners do not make the wise decision to discontinue the activity, because it is certain as long as there are such places, there will be people who, turning anger into action, will continue to open and destroy the cages. For the animals, the Animal Liberation Front. And two people have been jailed to stop logging and strip mining in Illinois. In this story by James Anderson of Truthout, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Police arrested two activists at a blockade set up on Rocky Branch Road in Harrisburg, Illinois, early on March 28th to stop Peabody Energy from continuing logging operations part of the company's strip mine expansions. Daniel Goering, 20, and Alice Fine, 19, laid down on a tarp on the road to block the route to be used for logging that day. Along with other environmental activists and with the support of community residents directly impacted by Peabody's operations, the two tried to forestall and possibly prevent further strip mining and the proposed closure of Rocky Branch Road. Goering and Fine, a self-identified radical power couple, are students at Oberlin College in Ohio who joined with other activists intent on stopping Peabody, the largest private sector coal company in the world. It has been active in mining operations around Harrisburg, Illinois, since 1999. The arrest came on the heels of a Saline County board meeting on the evening of March 27th, at which Peabody sought approval for the closure of the road, a precursor to strip mine expansion in the area. The board decided to postpone a decision on the proposal to close the road until April 15th because of uncertainties regarding a temporary emergency road route. Approximately $15 million or more of commerce relies on the existing road, according to residents. Residents already said they did not foresee the deleterious effects Peabody's actions would have on the local ecosystem when the company first arrived and offered jobs. Judy Kellen, 74, a Rocky Branch Road resident since 1976, said Peabody's promise of jobs and the downplaying of consequences of mining operations made it seem like an acceptable proposal when she first served on the township board 15 years ago. Kellen said she did not realize at the time a cancer had just entered our township. She and her husband, Glenn, aimed to be as self-sufficient as possible when they moved to Illinois several decades ago. They raised chickens, stocked their pond with fish, planted orchard trees, kept a garden, and grew vegetables from asparagus to Swiss chard. Peabody's plan endangers that subsistence lifestyle and local life in general, she said. Despite Peabody using equipment locals consider too heavy and too large during the course of past work around Rocky Branch Road, Kellen said, the company higher-ups have not been arrested while the two young adults were. Yes, the kids were breaking the law, but so was Peabody, Kellen said, adding that the activists did it to preserve their future and in solidarity with local residents' resistance. Goering, one of the two arrested, is originally from Evanston, Illinois, and is studying cinema at Oberlin. He said he was in St. Louis for a week working on environmental activism when he learned of the Rocky Branch Road situation. My understanding coming in was that there's this road in the area that people really relied on that was going to be destroyed for coal mining, and people were mad, he said. After hearing from the community at the Tuesday board meeting, he said he came to understand why people were so upset. It was clear that those living around Rocky Branch were excited and would be energized by this kind of action, and they've been expressing that it's generating excitement and attention, Goering said, after he and Fine arrived in Saline County and spoke with concerned citizens such as Colin. After refusing to remove from the tarp, the two were seated upon in the middle of the road. The two exchanged a kiss before being cuffed and put into a police car. They were kept for about 2 hours in the Harrisburg County Jail. Fellow activists promptly posted bail to get them out. Certainly this isn't over after just our arrest, Goering said after being released. A good group of people from around the Midwest and beyond have attached to this struggle and are connecting to it, he said. Fine said the salience of the intertwined work from Ohio to Illinois, as well as the importance of the effective bonds built up through collective and direct actions, bodes well for people, if not for Peabody's profits. Southern Illinois is going to be a battleground for a while, and it's exciting to be able to get in on that, she said. And Native Trappers Defend Canadian Forests from Logging, in this story by Clement Sanborin, Agence France-Presse, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Beyond a clear-cut in Quebec's far north, marked by a sign that reads, "The Road of Destruction Ends Here," Aboriginal Canadians are fighting for an ancient forest and their traditional hunting rights. Canada's boreal forest is the largest intact forest in the world, comprising one-third of the forest circling the North Pole above the 50th parallel. In this remote part of Quebec province, just south of the frozen Broadback River, the coniferous forest is home to hundreds of wildlife species, including the endangered woodland caribou. For centuries, Cree tribesmen have also lived and hunted in these woods. They lived without hindrance until the 1970s, when logging and the construction of hydroelectric dams in the James Bay region started to encroach on them. In 2010, a dozen Cree tallymen, tasked with supervising trapline activities, decided to take a stand on behalf of 16,000 Cree who live in this area and block logging roads in protest. They say logging offers few benefits to the indigenous people while damaging the environment. The sign on a dirt road 6 kilometers south of the river represents their last stand. They have demanded that some 13,000 square kilometers, around 5,000 square miles of wilderness north of the marker, be set aside for a nature preserve. Forest companies had agreed to a logging moratorium, but that expired last June, and the Grand Council of Crees has yet to reach an accord with the Quebec government. The future of the forest is an issue in the province's general election. The Liberal Party, which is leading in the polls, favors massive exploitation of untapped natural resources in Quebec's far north. The Liberals' main rival, the Parti Québécois, has also pledged to significantly boost logging in the province over the coming years. According to the latest government figures, Quebec's forest industry is the largest in the country, employing close to 70,000 people. The industry accounts for 2.7% of the province's gross domestic product, exporting billions of dollars worth of lumber, pulp, and paper each year. But it has struggled with every up and down of the global economy. At least they haven't started handing out exploitation permits yet, said Steve Blacksmith, the natural resources administrator for the Cree Reserve of the Waswanipi. Standing in the middle of a log section of his former trap line, Don Saganash points in every direction and laments, "We can't hunt here. The animals don't have any shelter anymore. We can't even trap marten anymore," echoes his cousin Malcolm. "This winter I caught none, whereas before I could catch 100. Hunting is not just for subsistence or sport, but at the heart of Cree culture, and has been recognized in Canadian law as a right for natives nationwide. But those rights are being tested by lumberjacks pushing further and further north," Don says. From time to time, forestry industry representatives stop in at Don, Malcolm, and another cousin Philippe's hunting camp deep in the woods to announce plans for logging nearby and offer the trio compensation. "I say no, but they still move forward," says Malcolm. Philippe says that there are now 3 forestry companies on his land, traditional Cree territory. "They never ask for permission. They don't care about what we think," he says. The winters here are growing shorter and caribou are becoming scarcer due to forest clear-cutting and more predatory wolves finding their way north along the logging roads. The Cree fear that they are witnessing the twilight of their ancestors' way of life. Huddled around a wood-burning stove to cook moose meat in the Cree village of Waswanipi, about 120 miles south of the Saganash cousin's log cabin, Cree elders are unanimous. "The water, the fish, the meat in the region don't taste the same anymore," says Alice Happy Jack. "I feel sad." With heavy eyelids, Joseph Niposh explains in a Cree drawl that he has lived all his life in the forest and that the Cree have a spiritual connection to the land. "Destroying the forest is destroying us," he said. And American Rivers announces America's Most Endangered Rivers of 2014. The report highlights challenges of excessive diversions, drought, outdated water management, all of which threaten the number one San Joaquin River in California. American Rivers has announced its annual list of America's most endangered rivers, naming California's San Joaquin River the most endangered river in the country. Outdated water management and excessive diversions compounded by the current drought have put the San Joaquin River at the breaking point. American Rivers is calling on the California State Water Resources Control Board to increase flows in the river to protect water quality, fish, and recreation, and to support sustainable agriculture. American Rivers is also urging Congress to preserve agreements and laws designed to protect the San Joaquin River and the jobs and communities it supports. The San Joaquin River is ground zero for water supply challenges, but it is also fertile ground for new and innovative water supply solutions, said Bob Irvin, president of American Rivers. We want a future with a healthy river and sustainable agriculture. This most endangered river listing is a call to action for all of us to come together around solutions to protect and restore reliable and predictable clean water supplies and a healthy river for future generations. We're all in this together. 4 million people live and work in the San Joaquin watershed. The river and its tributaries support some of the most productive and profitable agriculture in the world, irrigating more than 2 million acres of arid land. However, the river is so heavily exploited that it runs dry in certain stretches. The current drought is placing additional stress on the river and revealing inadequacies of status quo water management for both people and the environment. On the San Joaquin and across the nation, communities can increase their ability to deal with drought now and in the future by protecting and restoring rivers and using water more effectively, said Irvin. By prioritizing healthy rivers and sustainable water management, we can enjoy reliable, clean water supplies, healthy fish and wildlife, recreation, and a quality of life for generations to come. For the second year in a row, the America's Most Endangered Rivers report underscores the problems that arise for communities and the environment when we drain too much water out of rivers. Last year, the Colorado River was number one on the list because of outdated water management. The Colorado River Basin remains in the spotlight this year, with water diversion threats placing the Gila River and the rivers of the Upper Colorado Basin on the most endangered list. The annual America's Most Endangered Rivers report is a list of rivers at a crossroads where key decisions in the coming months will determine the river's fates. Over the years, the report has helped spur many successes, including the removal of outdated dams, the protection of rivers with wild and scenic designations, and the prevention of harmful development and pollution. For the full list of all of America's Most Endangered Rivers of 2014, please go to www.americanrivers.org. And we turn to biological diversity news. Taking aim at a secretive agency that kills 1.5 million wild animals yearly. For decades, the federal agency calling itself Wildlife Services has been massacring native wild animals, currently more than 1.5 million of them every year. Not only that, the secretive killing, including by aerial gunning, traps, and exploding poison caps, has gone on for decades with little public oversight and few rules. In 2012, for example, the agency's killed or euthanized list included more than 306,000 red-winged blackbirds, 76,048 coyotes, 25,000 beaver, 12,000 prairie dogs, 10,000 voles, 1,800 foxes, 567 black bears, and 500 wolves. The Center for Biological Diversity filed a petition to put an end to the carnage. We're calling for the U.S. Department of Agriculture agency to operate under new rules to ensure that animals aren't killed without cause, but always for reasons backed up by the best science. That animals aren't killed by accident, that animals are only killed as ethically as possible when non-lethal means are exhausted, and that reliable information on all killings is made public. Under various names, Wildlife Services has killed millions of a large variety of native animals since the early 20th century at the behest of agribusiness. It contributed to the decline of gray wolves, Mexican wolves, black-footed ferrets, prairie dogs, and other species during the first half of the 1900s, and by its own admission has killed more than 22 million native animals in the past 17 years alone. Wildlife Services is a major threat to North American wildlife and must be reined in and held accountable, said Center Attorney Amy Atwood, who wrote the petition. And a court orders a new plan to protect whales' dolphins from deafening Navy sonar. Whales, dolphins, and other marine mammals hurt by the U.S. Navy's high-intensity sonar may finally get some relief. A federal judge has told the National Marine Fisheries Service that it has until next August to come up with a plan to ensure that the Navy's war games along the West Coast comply with the Endangered Species Act. The decision stems from a lawsuit filed by the Center for Biological Diversity and their allies that challenged the Navy's use of waters from Northern California to Canada for activities like anti-submarine warfare exercises that use high-intensity sonar, which can severely harm or even kill whales and other marine mammals. The court ruled in 2013 that the Fisheries Service had approved the Navy training program based on incomplete and outdated science. The recent ruling sets a precedent-binding deadline for a new plan to protect marine mammals. Coming up with a new plan that will protect whales and dolphins from hearing loss, injuries, and death by sonar is an urgent priority, said Miyoko Sakashida, our Oceans Director. And global warming could rock mussels worlds, too. They aren't pikas or polar bears, but North America's freshwater mussels also face a daunting future because of global warming. A new study from the U.S. Geological Survey says these mussels, already suffering from pollution and habitat destruction, will struggle to survive as rivers and lakes warm up. It isn't just the mussels that will lose out, though. They help clean the water and cycle nutrients for insects that feed freshwater fish. Mussels are also food for otters, fish, and other river animals. But if water temperatures rise even by a few degrees, it could put some mussels on the fast track to extinction. They're already the most imperiled group of animals in North America, says one of the USGS study authors. If we're not careful, they're going to wink out in front of our eyes. And Washington wolf pack numbers are up, and wolf livestock conflicts are down. Washington State recently announced its wolf population has now grown to 13 packs and 5 breeding pairs, with a minimum estimated 52 wolves. The state's wolf recovery has largely been driven by federal Endangered Species Act protections. The reintroduction of wolves into adjacent Idaho led to wolves dispersing into Washington. Notably, even though wolf population and pack numbers have increased, wolves were involved in far fewer conflicts with humans and livestock in 2013 than in the previous year. Non-lethal conflict prevention methods are paying off. Wolves are protected under federal law in the western two-thirds of Washington and under state law everywhere else, which helps prevent poaching and encourages ranchers to take preventative action to protect their livestock. Wolves are a resilient species, and they can make it if people are tolerant. But wolf killing is still a big risk and can have a huge impact on a population, said Amarok Wise, the Center for Biological Diversity's West Coast Wolf Organizer. These beautiful, ecologically important animals continue to need strong state and federal protections to fully recover in Washington. And protection has been sought for a rare silvery plant in Oregon and California. Silver Facetia is a beautiful white-flowered shrub whose leaves are coated with hairs that help it keep salt off in its seashore environment. But this plant isn't just pretty, it's also critical to its ecosystem. Its flowers are a rich source of nectar and pollen for native bees where it grows along the coast of southern Oregon and northern California. The Silver Facetia is the forget-me-not family member, and the Center for Biological Diversity and its allies are making sure it's not forgotten. They have petitioned to protect it under the Endangered Species Act to help ensure its survival, which is now threatened by off-road vehicles, development, and non-native beach grass taking over its turf. There are now only about 30 surviving populations of the plant. Silver Facetia is a unique part of the natural heritage of our coast, said Tiara Curry, a senior scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity. We could lose it forever if we aren't careful. Endangered Species Act protection is the best hope for protecting this beautiful plant for future generations. And the Bureau of Land Management has missed the mark on sage-grouse protection. A new draft plan from the Bureau of Land Management has revealed an uncertain future for the West's most famous dancing bird. Although impressive in geographic scope, since the BLM promises to revise land use on 60 million acres, the plans fall far short of what's needed to protect the greater sage-grouse, and in some cases they entirely ignore scientists' protection recommendations. An expert panel convened by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service identified key threats to the sage-grouse, including invasive plants, energy development, livestock grazing, wildfire, and agriculture. Maybe the memo to the BLM got lost in the mail? Along with sage-grouse, more than 350 other species call the sage steppe home, including pygmy rabbits, golden eagles, pronghorn, and mule deer. Please go to the website www.biologicaldiversity.org to take action. That's www.biologicaldiversity.org. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have this week for the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday evening here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you'd like to listen to a rebroadcast of this program, you could tune in to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM or live streaming on the web at www.freakradio.org at 3 p.m. on Friday for a rebroadcast of the show. If you live in Moscow, Idaho, you could tune in to 90.3 FM KRFP's new high power frequency on Monday nights at 9:30. Or if you want to go and listen on the web or download a podcast, go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net. And when you get there, search for Earth First Update or Earth First Radio News. I'd like to add that radioforall.net is in dire need of donations. They are a service that archives radio programs such as this one, produced by independent and pirate radio stations and shared around the globe, using the services of radioforall.net. But radioforall.net has gotten very, very far in the hole as they don't get all the donations that they need. So it's time for you to step up and support radioforall.net. Go to their website and go to the upper right-hand corner. There's a little star there which will take you to a place where you can donate to support radioforall.net. And I want to remind you that the Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. And Free Radio Santa Cruz is also a community-sponsored do-it-yourself radio station. I urge you to go to www.freakradio.org and click on Donate. And there you can support Free Radio Santa Cruz and the studios that where this broadcast are recorded. Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio. It's produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We want to thank you for listening and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.